Now, if you will just announce yourself, your name and your organization, now we'll get it to start just to pick a cut between. This is Robert Moses.
I'm with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
And SNCC it is, isn't it?
SNCC, right.
In Jackson, Mississippi. It's February the 11th. Just as a kind of warm-up, where were you born, Moses?
Well, in New York City, in Harlem. And I was raised in Upper Harlem, Harlem River House. Went to the schools in Harlem until high school. And then I went to Stuyvesant High School downtown.
What accounted for that shift, that school shift?
That was a special school. He took an exam, citywide exam. And so that was an opportunity to, to get a fairly good high school education.
What was the ratio of Negroes to whites in Stuyvesant School at your time?
I think I was usually the only Negro in my class. I think maybe out of a graduating class of a few thousand, there were not more than a handful of Negroes.
Did Negroes try for it, or was this just seem something not worth trying for?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I know that at the same time when I went to junior high school, they first started these special classes in at least in the Negro schools, and we were encouraged to take these exams.
These were cram classes or special classes aiming for Stuyvesant?
There were special classes aiming for rapid advancement.
Yes, yes.
2.5 years instead of 3 years in junior high school, and they tried to get people from the elementary schools who had shown some ability or some the test scores or things like that were good. But as over a citywide basis, my impression would be that there was usually no effort really in the Negro, say junior high schools, to prepare people for the test and to encourage them to take it.
Was there also a considerable apathy, a sense of uselessness of the effort among students, kids?
I think there would be, that they would have had the feeling that they wouldn't have been able to pass, wouldn't be able to qualify, but that would be something that's out of their reach.
I've heard it said here in the last few days that part of the problem of voter registration is the fear of not passing, not the fear of reprisal in many cases. Some fear of being incompetent for the tests for registration.
I think that what that fear is the fear of being embarrassed. At the registrar's office of being in the position which a Negro is very often in of not knowing the answer and therefore thinking that it's their fault and being embarrassed.
Let's cut back to your earlier career after Stuyvesant High School. At what date was that, by the way?
I graduated from Stuyvesant in 52, so it was 3 years, 49, 52, and then I went to Hamilton College.
Yes, in New York.
In New York State, and I graduated from there in 56, and went on right to graduate school at that time. I went to Harvard in philosophy, and stayed there for a year and a half. I picked up an MA at the end of my first year. And then we had family. My mother died. And, next year, and my father was hospitalized, and I dropped out. And I got a job teaching at Horace Mann.
Yes.
And I was in 58 and stayed there 3 years. And I came down here.
Were you ambitious academic when you went to Harvard? You wanted to go to teach philosophy?
Well, I wanted to get a doctorate. I was interested. I liked philosophy, so I wanted to study. I wasn't sure whether I would teach with it or not, but there wasn't anything else at that time that I really wanted to do, and I did want to to study, so I just was in a degree program.
Now, how did you make the shift to active participation in civil rights operations?
The shift, it was really a big break. I wasn't active at all in any kind of civil rights organization, say, while I was teaching, until 1960, in the second year, when the sit-ins broke out. And that attracted my attention. It seemed to me as if there was something different, something new, and I was feeling for a long time that...
Before the issue had the feeling?
Yes. Certainly there was continual build-up and frustration back, I guess, as early as high school, and then in college and in graduate school, and then in teaching, of confronting at every point the fact that as a Negro, I mean, first that you had to be treated as a Negro, and you couldn't really be accepted as an individual yet, even at any level of the society in which you happen to penetrate.
You wouldn't have found it, you think, if you had continued with your work at Harvard and taken your doctorate as planned, and then going out to some good college or university to teach? You think you would have still had this as a personal experience, not an observed thing, but a personal experience?
I think that, I don't know if I would have. The fact, and I really didn't, you know, project it like that, the fact was always that at any given moment, in whatever experience you were in, it always cropped up. And that gradually, I got the feeling at least that no matter what I did, that it would always be there. That at that time, it wasn't possible, even though there are a lot of things that were much better, much different than, say, from my father's time. But in terms of my own expectations and what I had grown up with, it wasn't possible to be accepted fully as an individual.
May I test this just a half second? Had your father had aspirations and ambitions like your own?
Probably, yes. I mean, he was caught in the Depression with two families. First, his own family that he'd grown up with, his father became sick, and then he got married, and so he got, and he had finished high school. He hadn't gone to college, but there was no money for anyone. And he decided he got a job working in the armory, as part of state employee. And then he decided to keep that. I mean, and he really, we had long talks and heated discussions as we were growing up about this, talks which I see now as talks really about the question of opportunity and the question of discrimination, but which then were questions, you know, which revolved around whether or not he was satisfied, whether or not, you know, his whole purposes in life, what were they? Were they frustrated? Anyway, he decided to put most of his energies into his personal family, the three of us.
And yes.
He wanted to see us all through school and through college, and most of the sacrifice went in that direction. And for whatever reasons, he decided that there wasn't opportunity out, say, in the general world.
It sounded as though you were fairly close to him.
Yeah.
When did you make the actual step to leave teaching and to move into this work?
Summer of 60, I decided to come down and see what it was like. And I went down to Atlanta. SNCC was just organizing then. So I worked for them for a while. Actually, I came down to work with SCLC, Dr. King, but they were in the process of reorganization and changing executives. There was no place to fit in.
Since we're on that point, let me read you a quotation from Dr. Kenneth Clark on Dr. King and see how you respond to it. On the surface, King's philosophy appears to reflect health and stability. While black nationalism, he'd been talking about the Muslims, betrays pathology and instability. A deeper analysis, however, might reveal that there is also an unrealistic, if not pathological, basis in King's doctrine. The natural reaction to injustice is bitterness and resentment. The form which such bitterness takes need not be overtly violent, but the corrosion of the spirit involved seems inevitable. It would seem, then, that any demand that the victims of oppression be required to love those who oppress them places an additional and intolerable psychological burden upon the victim.
Plus, we don't agree with King's philosophy. I mean, in that sense, most couldn't find any of the students who would do anything but, I guess, they would ridicule, and usually most of them, majority of them, are not sympathetic to the idea that they have to somehow love the white people that they are struggling against. There are a few within the group, say, who have a very religious orientation.
SNCC, you mean?
In SNCC, still, who preach this, and this constant dialogue and discussion at meetings about nonviolence and the meaning of nonviolence and that kind of thing.
But nonviolence for SNCC is tactical nonviolence, is that it?
For most of the members in SNCC, it's tactical, and it's a question of being able to have a method of attacking rather than always being on the defensive and having to wait until something happens to you and then try and do something about it. But instead, you know, just go right out and do something about it. Be able to launch an attack. This would not be possible through organizing for a violent attack or anything like that.
What about the effect that King has had at moments of crisis where violence seemed imminent, general violence, as in Birmingham, the effect that he has been able to exert on people who are not avowed followers of his?
Well, there's no question that he has a great deal of influence with masses of people. I don't know. Certainly, I don't think that effect is in that direction of love. I think the effect is in the direction of practical step. That is that whatever you believe, you simply can't afford to have a general breakdown of law and order.
This is a matter then of a tactical nonviolence and a looking forward to the society to be created. Is that it?
I think that is a strong argument. I think that, I mean, that the argument that somehow that the question of that in the end everybody has to live together, and the local people, Negroes, understand this very well, and they're the first to tell you this. That they put it in terms of when you all are gone, we'll still be here, and we have to live with the people here.
You all being the workers who come in and then they go away next week, maybe.
That's, yeah. Except that we tried very hard to heed that problem, and to, especially in the work here in Mississippi, to the idea has been to send in workers in the communities where they stay and live and work, so that it isn't this moving in for a brief time and moving out again. So that the concept has been to work with some of the students and to prepare them to the point where they are ready to take a year off from school, and some of them have taken longer, and go and really live in these communities and work and stay there.
The attitude you attribute to a report from the local people, when you are gone, we have to stay here, to live here. Offhand, that might have either of two meanings. One, we have to pick up the pieces and bear the burden of reprisal or difficulties that are left. The other would be some vision of a society which was lawful in itself. As one could be a negative argument in its orientation, one a positive argument, a real vision of a law-abiding and humane society.
Exactly. Well, I think that as they express it, when they talk to you about the workers, it's largely in that negative sense.
In the negative sense.
But in an appeal, since they use that language, in an appeal about the community afterwards, that can be an appeal which they understand. That is, that in the end, the Negroes and the whites are going to have to share the land here. And that the less overlay of bitterness that you have, or the less marks of violence that you have to overcome, the more chance. And what you're looking for really is a way to bring about these changes, and with the least amount of this kind of bitterness. That is, you're constantly trying to find different ways in which, you know, you can get real change, but still not leave such a legacy that it's not possible to have some reconciliation and people working.
I talked back in November at the Nonviolence Conference at Howard. At lunch, I sat beside Miss Lucy Thornton, who's in law school there and has been through the jails and the picket lines and so forth. She's second in her class, a very, very brilliant girl. And she began the conversation by saying she had hope, a real hope, of a reasonable society in the South. She said, because the Southern white man and the Southern Negro have a shared history. There have been a long history of human recognitions and relations, even though these relations are sometimes bitter and violent ones. But at least there was a human context. She said, we have all been on the land together, the same land together, and this means something. She then said, I'm pessimistic, or I'm frightened, I forget the exact phrase, of the big northern city. We're just going to come out of the big northern city. So at least it would be much more difficult there, she said. Now, she is raised on a farm in backcountry Virginia, she told me. Does that make any sense to you or not? Or she
well,
a dreamer?
I really don't know. The country has such tremendous problems. See, when you start to talk like that, then you... I mean, every time the problems which we've run into now is that everywhere you go to try and get a breakthrough in, say, the Negro problem, you run into a tremendous problem that the country as a whole has to face.
The United States as a whole?
Right. The question of jobs, question, the whole question of education. All these things that tied so deeply into problems that run into the major, run deep in the major institutions of the country, and the whole question of the automation and run right into the question of peace and armament and how much of the resources of the country are diverted, you know, into that area and how much are needed in this area, and so that always you get back to economic and political questions, and they are intertwined with these kind of questions which he raises about human values and historical questions, and then I get lost, and I really do. I can't see that far ahead to what the shape of this country will look like 10 years. I mean, it's going through some, as I understand it, fantastic changes. That is, that will be as deep as, say, the Industrial Revolution.
It's fantastic. The technological revolution is
yes.
Fantastic. There's another person who says that. Let me change the subject a little bit. You hear it said, now and then I think Baldwin writes this, that there's no such thing as solving the southern problem without solving the northern problem. But the northern problem, as the race problem in the north, is really, in a sense, prior, by implication, to the southern problem, or at least parallel to it, and cannot be postponed after a solution of the southern problem.
I agree with that. And, one thing that I thought, I was very impressed by the Supreme Court decision and the fact that it wasn't until the whole country sort of began pounding away at the South about desegregating the schools that you began to get some action in the North about desegregated schools. I remember I was at Hamilton and a law professor from NYU came up and talked about these schools, and I told him that it had just dawned on me that I went to segregated schools all my life, as far as public and junior high schools were concerned, and that most of the Negro students in New York City went to segregated schools, and that was, of course, that was something that he psychologically didn't accept, that the schools weren't really segregated. It was a question of the housing pattern. And the North is going through this time and again, Boston and other places, a big battle with people to see whether or not they do have segregation. And of course they want to say that it's not in the area in which they're concerned. The educators don't want to say they're launching segregated schools. That's a problem of housing. The housing people say it's a problem it's not a race problem, it's a class problem. With people being prepared and having jobs and things, and you're back to the people who employ people, and they tell you it's an educational problem, and it's a vicious circle. And that's.
What do you think of the school struggle in New York right now? The attempt to use buses to balance schools. Does that make sense? Or is it tactics? I've had people in the North, Negroes in the North, say, I don't believe in this, it's stupid, but it's a tactic, it's a weapon.
It's a weapon to use.
Do you have any convictions about that?
Or I haven't been, you know, been so removed from that. And of course, the whole question is that the whole school system around the country is poor. It's inadequate. It doesn't meet the needs and the times. And the problem is to find a way to bring the whole thing up. I mean, it doesn't seem, you can't ever psychologically have any people take them from something, someplace up here, and ask them for the good of the value of integration or something like that to drop down to this level. And what you have to do is find a level up here that both can be moved up into so that they both have the feeling that they're moving in.
You mean the level of education is the key problem and not the percentage of white children bust into a Negro school, is that it?
Right, that somehow that really millions and millions of dollars have to be put into Negro education as it exists. At the same time as you're moving to integrate and to find ways in which the students can live together and study together, but also this whole question of housing and the jobs has to be tackled. But
you think that's prior, really, to the all the, or is it just a circle?
Right now, it's just a circle. I mean, it's farther for the mass of the people. There's some 10%, 15 maybe, that it's not a circle anymore. But for the mass of people, it's just a circle, and it looks like it's getting worse. I mean, the national percentage-wise, the Negro earns less now percent of white incomes they than used to. And that's, you know, it's decreasing all the time. And it seems as the gap will increase between the two because of the fact that the jobs available are for skilled people and there really is no, there's no national effort, and politically it's impossible to launch one at this time to bring all these people up, not just the Negro poor, but the white poor.
Back to your personal experiences, have you been the object of violence in Mississippi? Do you mind telling me about that?
Well, the...
A little detail?
The, happened when it first came down in 61. What happened was that summer in 60, I came down and then made a little trip through South, and in Mississippi found a person, who Amzie Moore, who wanted to work on registration.
Up in Cleveland.
Cleveland.
Yes, I met him last night.
Amzie and I sat down in 60 and plotted out a voter registration drive for the Delta and the state, that is, the need for it, and showed the county breakdown and things like that. And I went back to teach for a year and came back in 61. Well, then, couldn't get started in Cleveland. I came down to Macomb. And in the course of that drive, some farmers from the neighboring county, Amick County, came out. And we began taking people there. And one,
the farmers being Negro farmers?
Negro farmers. And once I was attacked on the way to the courthouse. There were two farmers and myself.
With people to register?
We were going up to register and walking along the main street in the town, and three white young fellows came up, and one of them began to pick an argument and began, they had singled me out and began to beat on me. And I had about, I guess, eight stitches on the top of my head.
Beat on with a fist or with a...
Well, apparently it turned out later that he had a knife, which was closed.
Using that as a kind of a...
Using that as a...
Bludgeon.
We went to trial, and a couple of days later, he was acquitted.
this a jury trial? No.
Was it? Yeah, that was very interesting. We came
back. In 2 days you had a jury trial?
Yeah, we came back in town. The town's reaction was interesting because it was this little town, Liberty, about maybe 1,000 people.
Which town is this now?
Liberty.
Liberty, Mississippi.
Amick County.
Yes.
And it has a long and vicious history. In fact, just last week, one of the farmers down there was killed, Lewis Allen, and
he was killed. He said he'd be a witness in another murder trial, hadn't he?
Right. In fact, and the other murder trial was the trial which grew out of the voter registration that summer in '61. And there were several acts of violence. First was my getting beat. A week later, another one of the workers got beat. And we called off the drive, and about a month later, this farmer got killed, which led to Lewis's participation in the trial, and he had to testify. And he wanted to tell the truth, and he told the truth to the FBI, but the local authorities, he told them what they wanted to hear. And so now,
excuse me, he told the local authorities what they wanted to hear, but told the FBI the truth. Mm-hmm.
And we believe that the FBI leaked it to the local authorities, and some of the sheriffs, the deputy sheriffs, came out, you know, and told him, Lewis, what they had learned.
This being Lewis Allen again.
Lewis Allen again. And they have been picking at him ever since. That was in September 61. At one point, the deputy sheriff broke his jaw, and that deputy is now sheriff, and then they killed him.
How was he killed?
A shotgun, and they, whoever it was, laid in wait for him in some bushes next to his wire fence. And it was at nighttime, he was coming back, and he had to get out of the truck to unhook the fence, and when he got out, they just shot him.
And has he been an arrest on that?
No arrest. I doubt that there will be.
Do you believe there's a possibility that the leak was intentional?
Well, I believe that, and we said as much to the Justice Department, and I said so before.
Is that your only experience of that sort?
Where I myself was attacked. Yeah. Except, well, no, I forgot. We were last year in Greenwood. We were driving along just out of town. It was the end of February. And some white people had been circling the town for about 3 or 4 carloads. White people. One of them followed us out of town. With 3 of us were in the car. I was sitting up front in the middle seat, and they opened up about 7 miles out of town. They just bullets rained just all through the car. The driver had a bullet in his neck, and he was slumped over into my lap, and he went off the road. Had to grab the wheel and stop the car. And he almost lost his life. He had a 45 that had lodged about just about an inch from his spine. And none of the rest of us were just shattered with glass. We weren't hit at all. That, I think, is interesting because Beckwith, the fellow who killed Medgar,
yes,
is from Greenwood.
Yes.
And the people who...
Beckwith.
Yeah, the people who... Well, no, the people who shot us, that the police arrested, at least there were some arrests in that case. And they answered to the same general description, that is, they are middle-aged, middle-class, white people, sort of, just as Beckwith is. Now, they'd never been brought to trial yet.
To the same general type as Beckwith.
Yeah, and I think that there was a whole conspiracy up there. And we wrote letters to the telegrams to the Civil Rights Commission stating this and asking them to investigate. Of course they say that. You know, there are no grounds. Just one says there's no grounds.
You're recently married, aren't you?
Yes.
What view does your wife take for your hazardous occupation?
Well, that's hard to say, but she doesn't. I guess it's what you do is that you don't really confront that. I mean, you just go on. You just go on living. I mean, it's in my found that it's really impossible to confront that, even after that kind of narrow escape.
You take it day by day.
Yeah, because otherwise it's not. There is no real way to confront that except within yourself. You try and you have to overcome that fear. And that took, for me, you know, quite a while.
Can you put your philosophy to work on that? Did the Harvard seminar help you any?
Not the Harvard seminar. I went back a little further. When I was in college, I had a French professor who, we did a lot of work in 20th century French lit, and I read a lot of Camus.
And that's interesting. That connection.
Picked it up again. I just finished while I was in jail this last time. I read Through the Rebel and The Plague again. And
where were you in jail then?
This was in Hattiesburg.
Just now?
About a week and a half.
Yeah, just this last week. Yes. So you read Camus in jail?
Yeah. I think, you know, the main essence of what he says is what I feel closest to.
Will you state that?
That it's important to struggle, that there's the sense of working against some of these forces, that it's important to recognize in the struggle certain humanitarian values, and to recognize that these you have to struggle against the for people, in that sense, and that at the same time, if it's possible, you try and eke out within that, it's possible to eke out some corners of love or of some glimpses of happiness within that. And that's what I think, more than anything else, to prevent the bitterness, I say that kind of Clark talks about.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can you hold it a moment?
Sure.
This is the end of tape one of Robert Moses. Resume on tape two.